Hello and welcome back to this conference all about healing toxic relationships and cultivating healthy, happy ones. My name is Jai Bristow and I'm one of your hosts. And today I am super happy to be welcoming the wonderful Ali Hendry. Ali is a holistic relationship coach and a generally wonderful person. Welcome, Ali.
Hello, thank you for inviting me.
Thank you for joining us. So let's dive right in. What would you say is your definition of a toxic relationship?
For me, I think two main areas come up in terms of not feeling safe and not feeling supported. When those two things are not in place, that's when we're thinking about that toxic relationship. I think it's important to recognize that when we talk about a toxic relationship, we're talking about an entity, we're talking about a label, in the way that you might say a secure relationship or a committed relationship or an unhealthy relationship. And we need to remember that actually the relationship is made up of those individuals, whether it's two people or whether it's a non-monogamy setup. And so looking at those individuals and how they are within that dynamic. So with a toxic relationship, if it's a monogamous relationship, you've got two people in that relationship, you would expect both people to be asking themselves, what can I change and what am I prepared to work on? And what can't I change and what am I prepared to put up with?
Absolutely. And I think it's really important what you're saying about how, you know, a relationship isn't just one person. I mean, you can have a relationship with yourself, of course, but that when we're talking about relating with other humans, whether it's with one other human or multiple other humans, whether it's romantic relationships, friendships, family, that, you know, it's that question of how can I, yeah, what needs to happen for the relationship as a sort of field between you guys.
Yeah.
And I know that you've done a TEDx talk about jealousy. So maybe we can talk about that in the connection to toxicity.
Absolutely. I think when we talk about toxic traits, jealousy absolutely could be one of those traits. It could be unresolved conflict, control, lack of respect as well. And jealousy certainly could come under that. And my TEDx talk, Survivor's Guide to Jealousy, I talk about the differences between jealousy and envy. Quite often we can get confused about those definitions. Jealousy being that fear of losing something to someone else, and therefore there are three entities involved. And envy being wanting something someone else has, and therefore there only really needs to be two entities involved in that situation. And I think if we go into what toxic jealousy behaviors could be, they would be, I would put the focus on, well, what are the feelings? I feel undermined. I feel invisible. I feel my partner is deliberately flirting and deliberately ignoring me. So that's where those behaviors might show in terms of the toxicity. But I think when we think about jealousy, we have to be really clear on, is it actually jealousy? Because jealousy is an emotion. And so it starts in our bodies and we get this physiological response. And then our brain goes, hello, what's going on here? What's that? And it tries to make sense of what's going on in our bodies. And that making sense depends on the environment, previous experiences, what's happening, the dynamic between those individuals, whether it's occurred before. And so we can load in lots of information that may not be relevant to us interpreting this bodily sensation. And jealousy is a really complex emotion. So actually, if we can get clear on labeling what is going on, it might not be jealousy. It could be fear, rage, anger, resentment, humiliation, invisibility, longing, annoyance, uncertainty, frustration, worry. I mean, just so many other things that could be underpinning that. And overall, when I talk about jealousy, I talk about, well, what's the need that's not being met here? Can you identify that need? Because jealousy is a messenger. It's telling us something that we need to find out about.
Wonderful. And I think it's so important to as you say, like unpick, what does jealousy actually mean? Because it's one of those terms that gets used a lot and in a lot of different situations. And as you say, first of all, differentiating between jealousy and envy. And I love the definitions you gave, the idea that jealousy is that like fear of losing something, that wanting to hold on, whereas envy is the wanting something you don't have. And those are two very different things, even though the words are often used either interchangeably or jealousy is used when in actual fact it's envy. And then as you explore even further into that jealousy and into what that actually is, like you say, there's a whole array of emotions. And so thinking of jealousy more as a sort of like umbrella term rather than just I'm feeling jealous, and often jealousy can come with a lot of blame, I've noticed. You know, it's like it's that kind of I'm jealous because my partner, my friend, my lover, my whoever it is exhibiting things, you know, toxic behavior or toxic patterns or whatever it is, as opposed to thinking, okay, I'm feeling jealous. What's actually going on for me? What's happening in my body right now? So I think that's really important definition and distinctions that you're making here, and bringing it back to what is the actual emotion that's happening within that, rather than just my partner's making me jealous, or, you know, I'm because even jealousy, sometimes it's I'm feeling jealous, but sometimes it's they're making me jealous, or they're doing things, they're trying. I've heard this a lot as well. They're trying to make me jealous. Like, what's that all about? So I really appreciate what you're bringing in here.
As soon as you take it outside of your own experience, and like you say, you bring in that blame piece, you are giving away your power. You are saying, I'm not in control of this. I can't do anything about this. And as a result of that, you are left hanging, basically. And so if you can bring it back to you and say, right, this is what's going on for me. They are doing this action, and I am feeling this. If we can take away that cause and effect, and we can stay with what's going on for us, then actually we can process that a lot easier rather than handing it over to somebody else. And sitting with the feelings, you know, I really struggled with this this phrase of, and this is what we talk about in the coaching environment, sit with the feelings, absorb what's going on. And I struggled with finding a way of sort of conceptualizing this. And then I came up with some things that help clients in different ways, depending on whether they're a visual person, a kinesthetic person, you know, what the way that they operate in the world. And for some people, they like to visualize the idea of actually sitting in a bath of jealousy. Sit in that bath, and what is coming up for you? What's swirling around? So they want that imagery. For others, they want to have some kind of movement with intention. So they might take jealousy for a walk and have a conversation with jealousy. For others, they might want to get more into the connection with spirituality and higher self. They might want to do some journaling. They might want to write a letter to their jealousy. There might be some meditations that they want to go through. Insight Timer is a fantastic free resource, an app that you can use, and you can just plug in jealousy meditation. And you don't have to be still with meditation. This, I think, is a real area that we need to dispel those myths that you need to be sitting in a certain way, you know, closed eyes, complete stillness. It's not true. You can meditate by going for a walk in nature and tuning in to what's around you, the sights, the sounds, the smells. That's meditation in itself. And especially when we talk about people who are neurodivergent and their idea of how I need to be to meditate, that may not work for you if we're feeding into this way of being that actually doesn't have to be like that. We make something that fits for us. You might do a playlist, a jealousy playlist, and dance around the kitchen, and that's the way that you're processing that emotion.
And I love that, you know, all these tools you've given are really about engaging with the jealousy rather than either disconnecting from it, repressing it, judging yourself for experiencing it, judging the other person for making you feel that way. You know, it's really, it's not so much about getting rid of it or judging it or anything. It's really about, yeah, all these different tools, whilst they're different strategies, they're all about engaging with it, either like sitting in a bath with it, either journaling about it, talking to it, you know. And so how, obviously you're a holistic relationship coach and you specialize in coaching, like why and how is coaching different to interacting with jealousy than other therapeutic tools like, you know, counseling or psychotherapy or those kind of tools?
It's a great question. I'm a big advocate of both. I've had therapy before. I'm sure I'll have it again. And it is a great starting point. I always think it's a great starting point for healing, for looking at the past, trying to make sense of the things that happened, trying to answer that eternal question, why did that happen? And it's a really powerful medium for exploring self. Where coaching comes in, it kind of picks up, I would say, sometimes where therapy finishes in terms of future. So what's going on for me now? Coaching focuses on where am I at now, getting clear on where I'm at now, and where do I want to get to? And what are the steps that I can take that are manageable and sustainable to take me into my new future? Now, that said, there are therapies that do use coaching methodologies. Cognitive behavior therapy deals with behavior change. Positive psychology is a form of coaching. So there are overlaps, and in both instances, you're creating that safe container. You are with your client along their journey. You're not imposing any of yourself. You know, it's a safe, open container. I find that from coaching, it can feel more expansive, and there can be bringing in more support around what else is available outside of self. So where therapy is great for looking at self and developing self, coaching looks at us within a wider remit. So us within society, within communities, within relationships, and it can work really, really powerfully. Because I'm an educator as well as a coach, sometimes I will bring in, with permission, and obviously if we've contracted for that, I will bring in some exercises that people can do to help them move through. And some of the things I mentioned earlier, working out what's best for the client. What do they want? What are they going to stick to? Because if they don't like it and if it doesn't match them, they're not going to stick to it. And this is where you have to go where the client wants you to go. They're driving the car. You're just sitting next to them, helping them navigate the road ahead. And I love that. I love that I get to do that. So what I would do is I would explore things like around jealousy. What is that unmet need? What is yours? What's your partner's? What might be a feature of the relationship? Where does that entity land? Is it yours? Is it theirs? Is it the relationships as a whole? What movement do you need that will shift that emotion? And we're not talking about pushing it away. We're just talking about dislodging it so that we can see what's underneath it and see where we can go with it and what we can do about it. So having that autonomy, feeling empowered to take some actions that help you and help your partner and help the relationship, partner or partners. And then celebration. This is something that we forget to do all the time as humans, celebrating those successes, those small wins, those moments where you chose a different behavior. You didn't do what you always do. You did something new. And when we celebrate, we stimulate dopamine. We create those pathways that allow us to feel motivated next time. And that is a wonderful thing.
I love that. I love that kind of like positive reinforcement, motivating by celebration, because so often, you know, as we go through these healing processes, whether we're healing, you know, traumas, and which is all very much linked to toxic relationships, we don't have toxic relationships without trauma, right? And like, as we go through these healing journeys, it can sometimes feel like a long, unending road. And so to take those times to notice, I broke that pattern. I did something different. I felt the urge to act in one way. I recognized the urge. I didn't like follow through, and I did something else. Or even, oh, I did do the thing, but I noticed that I was doing the thing as I was doing it rather than noticing 3 years later. Right.
Yes.
So I think it's really wonderful to bring in that piece about, like, yeah, celebrating, like, as well as working on the past and working on, you know, what needs to happen and the work that still needs doing. It's having those moments of celebrating the journey that's been done so far, celebrating where we're at now and everything that we have worked on, and really taking that time. Because as you say, like, cognitively, it's great, the release of dopamine and all of that. But it's also so important because you can get, like, I don't know if this is a thing, I'm sure someone talks about it somewhere, but like healing burnout, right? That sense of like where you're so focused on trying to evolve and heal and work on all your traumas and your past patterns. And sometimes it can feel, yeah, endless and exhausting. And I think you can get some form of burnout from that. So to have those moments of just let me celebrate how far I've come, I think is so wonderful. And I'm curious, Ali, because when I first asked you the question about your definition of toxic relationships, you talked about like the lack of security and safety and the lack of support. And so I'm wondering, as we talk about, you know, we're focusing very much on jealousy as one form of, you know, one element, one symptom perhaps of toxicity or something, an emotion that can be very linked to toxicity in relationships. Like, how does that connect to that lack of support, to that lack of safety? How does jealousy tie in with that?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And I think where it comes out is when we look at codependency and some of the areas that arise when there is that codependency. So, you know, the definitions around codependency, we're looking at things like a struggle to state our needs, to be true to ourselves, that fear of rejection, that phrase, I am not enough. And it can show in behaviors, you know, with codependency, some of the behaviors that come out around a codependency, you can see how they're aligned with some of the jealousy behaviors that show up as well. So we've got that clinginess, scared of being on your own, giving your power away, those blurred boundaries and devaluing yourself. So those codependent behaviors could also show up as jealousy behaviors. And I wouldn't want to suggest cause and effect between codependency and jealousy, but what I would want to do as a coach is explore how do we create ease? How do we create ease in these situations where it's tumultuous? There seems like there's no way out. I keep doing the same behaviors and getting the same outcome, and I want to do something different. And so we might explore areas like trust. We might explore areas like commitment. You know, commitment is a bit like love languages. It's like, how do I want to give my commitment? How do I want to give it? How do I want to receive commitment? And I think there's a whole piece of work around that. But when you start a new relationship, you kind of assume you both know, or, you know, depending on how many people are within that relationship, you understand what commitment means from your own experiences or from your own wants and needs. And yet the other person could be doing their darndest. And you're just like, where's the commitment? Where's the commitment gone? So having those conversations about how you would like it to show up in the relationship, and bearing in mind that how you show your commitment may not be how you want to receive it from the other person. So again, there's that nuanced conversation that needs to happen. So we might explore that. We might explore trust as well. And trust is one of those things, as a child, you're told, you've got to earn my trust. You've got to earn it. When actually, trust is in the hands of the giver. That's where the power is. I decide to give you trust. And so what I can do is I can have conversations about how I will feel safe and secure in giving my trust. These are the conditions that would work for me. And so we move into that piece around boundaries and what is my yes? What is my no? What allows you into my field, as I call it, when I talk about boundaries? So I think it's important to explore some of those wider themes that could be contributing to that codependency and that jealousy and how it's showing up in your relationships.
That's brilliant. I think it's such an important parallel between codependency and jealousy, and how one can be like an expression or symptom of the other, right? And I really, really loved that connection you made between how you show your commitment and love languages, because commitment, like love, is one of those words that gets mentioned and thrown around a lot. But unless you actually define it with someone, it can be really hard to know A, what it means, and B, how to express that, right? Which is why, like, love languages is wonderful, because as you say, you might express your love to someone in one way, you might like to receive love from someone in another way, and depending on who is at the receiving and giving end of your love, they might have their own ways of wanting to express and receive love. And so to do that with commitment as well, and to make that explicit, like, what does commitment look like to you? How do you want me to show your commitment? Is it, you know, making sure we always have dinner together? Is it like a weekly phone call? Is it daily texting and checking in? Is it, you know, whatever it is, rather than just assuming and then getting frustrated because the other person or people involved aren't expressing, you feel like they're not showing up in the ways that you would like them to, but you've never told them what that is, and vice versa. You know, they don't understand because they think that they are being very committed, and the way you're responding is saying that they're not, or that maybe they're not feeling the commitment from you, and you think, this is the most committed relationship I've ever had. What are they talking about? Right. So I think it's such an interesting parallel to have between that commitment and love languages. And especially, I think in monogamous relationships, it's true, but especially in non-monogamous relationships, where commitment isn't the traditional relationship escalator of you date, at some point you become exclusive, then at some point, you know, you move in together, maybe you get engaged, maybe you get married, maybe you have a family. All those are like well-known signs of commitment on a certain escalator. But when you're in non-monogamous relationships, often it doesn't reflect that. So it's even more important to have those conversations. And once again, this is where like mainstream relationships can learn from the alternative relationships about, you know, having those explicit conversations rather than just assuming you're on the same page because you're doing what society is telling you is quote unquote the norm.
Absolutely. And there are so many ways that when we talk about commitment, that we want to be seen. And for some people, feeling seen might be, I want us to have a connection at 6 o'clock every day, you know, whether we are in the same house or not. This is something that I need. And that is you and me feeling seen by you. Someone else might say, I need you to put the status as in a relationship on Facebook. And that for them is what they need. Whereas for the other person, they might be, but I don't care about that. I really don't care about that. Meanwhile, you're having all these conversations with your friends saying they're just not committed because look, they don't want to show me. Whereas for them, they show up for you every single day at 6 o'clock, come hell or high water. So you are missing a trick and you end up then looking for things that confirm, that's the cognitive distortions in us. You look for all these things that confirm that narrative that you've decided they're not committed. And you ignore all the things that go against this narrative that you've created. And the story becomes real in your head.
Absolutely. And I'm curious what happens when like some of the, like when it can be misaligned. For example, the example you said, one person might be like, oh, I want you to put on social media and that we're in a relationship. And the other person's like, I don't like social media. I don't want to do that. Or like, that doesn't make sense to me. And meanwhile, they're like, I want you to show up at 6 o'clock every day. And the other person's like, well, at 6 o'clock, I often, you know, leave work and go for drinks with my friends. I can't, you know, or whatever it is. What happens when there's a mismatch in that showing of commitment?
It's a great question. It comes back to what we were saying earlier. What is the need that is not being fulfilled? And do you need it in that way? Do you need it in that way? And if not, what other ways? What is the art of the possible in that relationship? How much are you prepared to compromise? How much is tied into that absolute? And it comes in with the boundaries side of things, you know, accepting what is absolutely, this is acceptable for me. This is my yes. This is what I, you know, this is my yes. And this is my no, as opposed to a rule. And as we know, the differences between rules and boundaries, I mean, when we talk about flirting, for example. So you might be going to a party and a rule would be you're not allowed to flirt. I mean, okay, that's very rule bound. Yep, you are just not allowed to do it. When we look at boundaries, we give a little bit more information and we say, actually, you might flirt, I might flirt. If you flirt, I might feel unsafe. And so can we make sure that we check in every half hour or so, just come over, a hug or a handhold, that's what I will need. And so we set that that's the boundary, you know, throughout the evening, can we keep checking in with each other every so often, particularly if you are chatting to someone for a while, can you then come and find me? I'll do the same because I need to feel safe and that will make me feel safe. If you're not able to do that, I won't feel safe and I'll leave the party. Now that's the consequence. And that's the bit where people struggle around setting boundaries and maintaining boundaries because it feels like it's a barbed threat. When actually what you're saying is this is what I need. And if I can't have it, I will find it somewhere else for now. And then we can have a conversation. It may be that you'll phone a friend or you'll go around to a friend's house after you've left that party. Another way, of course, is the agreements, which, as you know, and I know, with non-monogamous relationships, agreements are everything. So with those agreements, if you're going to that party, you would have a conversation about what's going to come up for you, how are you going to feel, what's going to work for you, what's going to work for me, and you would meet in the middle. I mean, it is as the word goes, we agree, we have that agreement, and we have clauses to it. So if this happens and that isn't possible, I can do this for you. And I think that's so healthy. So going back to your original question, it's getting curious. It's finding out what's underneath that. What do I actually need? Because if you don't want to put it on Facebook and I want it on Facebook, what is it about that outward sign and where else might I be able to get that? Is it because, and also you haven't introduced me to your family and we've been going out for a year. And actually that could be the key to it. The fact that I feel invisible, I'm not seen by your family, or I've never met your best friend for the last 2 years. That could be the issue. And so if we can ask the questions, then we can find the solutions.
I think that's super important. And I love that clarification between rule and boundary, because I know it's something a lot of people struggle with, and that a rule is imposing something on someone else's behavior. You can't do that. And rules can be very jarring because we feel controlled by them, and rules sometimes exist for good reason, and sometimes they're created together, you know, and sometimes they apply to both people, sometimes they apply to one person, whatever. I'm not anti-rules, but it's just understanding the difference between rule and boundary. Rule is imposing something on someone's behavior. A boundary is saying, here are my needs. This is the behavior that would support me with my needs. And if you're unable to do that, this is what I'm going to do to look after my needs. And it's not to punish you, but there are consequences. Like you say, the difference between you're not allowed to flirt, which already you have to then define what flirting actually means. And I think that's another thing that all this boils down to is communication, 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 right? But as opposed to, if I see you flirting, it would be really helpful to make me feel safe if you came and checked in on me. If you're unable to do that, I'm going to probably end up leaving, or I might end up going and spending the time with specific one partner, one friend, or whoever, someone that makes me feel safe, or whatever the case might be. And so again, really having that difference, because so often people say, I set a boundary and they didn't respect it, when actually they set a rule, or actually the boundary wasn't clear of what the consequences would be. And I think, you know, that thing of boiling down and finding the need, that's used a lot in nonviolent communication techniques as well. It's like we focus on the need and then we look at the different strategies. So saying, I need you to declare that we're Facebook, you know, official or whatever, that isn't actually a need. That's a strategy for the need of, oh, the need might be to be recognized, to be seen in this relationship, for example. And often the needs can be, you know, can grate against each other, which is when you have that kind of those boundaries or that discussion. It happened to me recently. I was in conflict with a friend and the friend needed like space and time, but I didn't know what was going on and I needed communication and clarity. So it's like, what do you do in that situation? And so it was really uncomfortable for me because I really wanted to respect that person's need for like space and time, but they hadn't set either a rule or boundary. They hadn't said to me, hey, I need this space and time. I'll check in with you in 1 week. Please don't contact me for that time. And if you do, I won't respond because I need space and time. That's a boundary. But just they started sort of ghosting me and responding really weirdly to messages. And I didn't know. So eventually I had to send them a message saying, I respect your space for need and time. And at the same time, I have a need for clarity and communication. Therefore, I think we should talk. Please let me know a time that would be good for you. If you're unable to meet me in this, I understand, but that will mark the end of the relationship for me because that way it's clear for me. Then I can start the grieving process and the mourning process of the end of the relationship. But I was just in this limbo, which was really painful because, yeah. And so again, it's that thing of, okay, those seemed like opposing needs, but and then they were able to say, okay, I need 2 more days and then we can talk. And then for me, that was clear. And I was, for example, and then we had a chat and yeah. And so I think it's really important again, to recognize the difference between rules and boundaries and to recognize the difference between rules and in NBC language, at least what's known as strategies or the ways that we have our needs met as opposed to the actual essential need. So like the example you were giving of like, okay, why are we getting so upset and possibly jealous about the fact that this person isn't putting us on, you know, on their social media? Is it what's the actual emotion? Is it really jealousy or is it what's actually going on here? What's the actual need and how can we communicate that in a way that's supportive as opposed to like conflict and passive aggressive and like, you never do anything. You never show me that. And like, you don't care about me. And then the person's taken by surprise. Like you're not clearly not committed to this relationship when actually they're like, what do you mean? Like I've done all these other things. And it's just, so I think it's all, and this is what I love about this conference and all these conversations I get to have with all you wonderful guests is just, you know, naming all these insidious things that happen so easily in relationships. And by naming them, that's when we can start to break the patterns. And then we get those moments of celebration when we break those patterns, but we can't break them without naming them. And so often we live in a world, in a society where we feel judged and we judge ourselves for not, you know, we read the fairy tales and it's like, and they meet, they kiss and they live happily ever after. And so we feel guilty. We're like, I love this person loves me. Why is it not quote unquote perfect, right? And so it's again, it's that connecting to the feelings, connecting to the needs, learning to communicate. And I just want to rewind a bit to what you said earlier about trust as well, because we didn't really fully unpack that and I didn't get to dive into it, sorry. Long day. And so I really love what you say about like trust is with the give of trust. It's like, what do I need to be able to trust you? This is what I need. And so it's not again about setting a boundary of like, oh, you know, you have to earn my trust, but I'm not going to tell you how, or like if you do this, you're not allowed to do this or you have to do this, but instead of this is who I am, this is what I need. And if you're unable to do that, I understand, but then that means I don't feel safe and I'm going to have to either have my needs met elsewhere or remove myself from this relationship or whatever the case may be.
So much of what we're talking about is that living in the unknown, not knowing is where that maelstrom happens. It's where that visceral feeling in the body, I don't have an answer for this, because we live in a world where, well, we live in a binary world in so many ways. It's either this or it's that. And so if anything is in between, we find it really, really difficult. And I think what's important is to resource yourself to be in the not knowing, and to seek ways of moving through that in the ways that we've talked about earlier, and getting the education and being clear on what could be going on here, and asking those right sorts of questions, and getting yourself resourced with the support that's around you, whether that is a coach or a therapist, or listening to a podcast together, reading a book together, sharing articles, etc., going on a learning journey together so that you can identify some of these areas. And looking at things like you said earlier around the flirting, you know, the question always comes up, is flirting cheating? Well, cheating is when you hide something. So if there are elements of your flirting that you wouldn't do in front of your partner, or you are deliberately hiding, then there could be elements of cheating in there. So looking at how that comes out and how you might address that. And how defensive are you when they call you on your flirting? I mean, that can be a sign as well of something that is going on, that, again, it's an unmet need. And maybe you do want excitement, and maybe you are just doing it for that dopamine hit, and that's okay. There is also that responsibility of being in partnership. If you've chosen to be in, whether it's monogamous or non-monogamous, whether you have chosen to give that commitment, go back to that commitment word, what that has to look like, and where flirting might be in that. Because flirting can be fun. It can be fun witnessing your partner or partners flirting with others. You can get that beautiful conversion feeling. Wow, someone else is attracted to them as well. That's hot. Or it can feel completely turn you off. Well, I feel invisible. So, or it can be in between. You know, jealousy is a kink. You can get turned on by jealousy. It doesn't have to be a negative emotion. It can be a zestful emotion as well.
I love that zestful emotion. And I'd love to talk more about that, although I'm aware of time, and I feel like that's a whole conversation for another time. Jealousy is a kink. But I think there's something really important in what you're saying about, you know, flirting and communicating. And for me, what I'm hearing is like, what's the intention behind it, right? Because again, that's why clarifying, what does flirting mean? And if someone sets a rule or boundary, it needs to be clearer than just you can or can't do that. You have to make sure you have the same definition of that thing. So for example, for me, flirting is about being playful. It's about connecting. And often there is not the intention to hook up with someone when I flirt. I flirt with my friends. I flirt with my friends' partners in a very, and I flirt mostly with people that I actually don't want to hook up with. If I'm actually interested in someone sexually, then I'm a terror, and then I'm useless at flirting a lot of the time. Not always.
That's true, because flirting is rapport building. Exactly. It is about rapport. It's one of those things we do.
Exactly. And so I'm curious as well, Ellie, because I know that, you know, you've learned a lot through your coaching and through therapy and through also the wonderful work you do with a relationship room and the Diva magazine, where you get to host and have amazing conversations with people. But you also, I think, have learned through your own relationships. So I'm wondering if you'd like to share some of the things you've learned from your own toxic relationships. And again, we're defining toxic relationships here as relationships where there's a lack of support, a lack of safety. And toxic, you know, is one of the things that we define in this conference. Like in the trauma conference, we define trauma isn't always these big, huge traumas. There's big T trauma, as it's sometimes known, or small T trauma, which I don't like that language, even though I use it a lot, but it's easier for people to understand. And I think it's true with toxicity as well, which is why it's really important to define it. So using your definition of toxic relationships, could you share about some of your experiences and what you've learned?
Absolutely. It's one of the things that we know as coaches, that we have to keep ourselves accountable for ourselves. we have to have our own support around us to be able to do what we do. We are asking you to be accountable. We are asking you to live your best life. If I don't attempt to do that for me, then I shouldn't be doing what I'm doing. So having my own coach supervisor, having the support around me. I'm a lead on a relationship coach training course, and about 70% of the course is around personal development. 30% is on the nuts and bolts of coaching, and 70% is getting you into the place that is right for being a relationship coach. So I'm always looking at my relationships. Yay to be in a relationship with me. And what I've learned is from the toxic relationships is you have to build and maintain your own support systems. You have to do that and make them holistic, make them to do with your nourishment of your mind, your body, and your spirituality or soul. So I invest daily in my friendships. I invest, there are friends that I contact every single day. There's one friend that we have a daily check-in. Every day we send a message that says, I am grateful for, and then we complete that, and I deserve, and then we complete that. We do that every day. We've been doing it for so, so long. I have other friends that every week at the same time, same place, we have a check-in phone call. So I'm accountable to them. They're accountable to me. They are my support crew. They really are. Prioritizing my own mental and physical well-being. And these are all things that have carried me through those relationships that have had those elements of toxicity. So the things like my daily yoga, kitchen disco, I play music in my kitchen, walking outside. I'm really getting into intentional eating and what that looks like. I'm going through menopause at the moment, so really interested in what my body is capable of now. I'm really curious about the changes and how I can embrace this new season. Having intentional time with pets, my lovely cat, and looking at ways of stimulating those, like we've mentioned earlier, those wonderful hormones that we've already got, oxytocin, dopamine, serotonin, all of those feel-good hormones, and what I can do being out in nature, dancing, movement, yoga, meditation, all of those things, and making sure that I have a daily practice. We call it a practice for a reason. A practice means sometimes you don't get it quite right. Sometimes you get it really well. Sometimes you don't do it at all. It's a practice. So be kind to you and accept that you are not always going to do it exactly in the way that you wanted to do it. And a big one is don't disappear down a social media hole. Because when I finished a relationship that at the time I felt was incredibly toxic, I started off by labeling my ex a narcissist. Then I went to, actually, I think we're probably both narcissists. Then I went to, it was just toxic traits. And then I went to attachment theory and just went through all of these different phases. And some of it was, what are the voices that I'm listening to on my social media? Oh, look, nearly every account that I'm following is to do with narcissism. So no wonder these are the messages that I keep getting. And actually, with distance, what I've realized about that particular relationship is me, the things that I didn't do. I was not consistent with my setting and maintaining boundaries. I know that. I was not clear enough on what commitment meant to me and how I showed my commitment. And I wasn't able to do the jealousy work that I have done since then, and that is in the TED Talk. So the work that I've done on me around managing my own jealousy journey would have served me. So knowing about the boundary work, you know, the commitment and definitions and my jealousy journey has served me well. That relationship has served me well because it's given me that insight into how I embrace my relationships now and in the future.
That's wonderful. Thank you. I'm so glad for all your learnings and for you sharing your learnings with us. And I think it's really beautiful what you're sharing about, you know, creating your own support network and making sure that you maintain that support network, even in your relationships, even when you get swept up in a new, exciting relationship, maintaining that accountability with people who have been in your life for a long time that you can trust, and that, you know, it's a two-way street with those people as well. And I think that's also a really good way of avoiding major red flags in people, because those friends, those people in your life will hold you accountable. And if anyone in your life tries to sever you from that support network, then that's also a major red flag. I have one of my friends at the moment who is, you know, dating some new people and sends me regular voice messages at the end of each day. And whether that friend is like getting overly excited and there seems to be some toxic flags, that's usually my traits. And then that friend calls me out on that when I'm dating. And their traits is someone that have nothing but green flags and they go into doubt. And I'll be like, no, this is on you. We always joke. She tells me her favorite thing about me is that I call her out on her bullshit. Like, I won't let her. I'm not the friend who's just going to like accommodate and be like, yes, you're always right. I'm like, no, you're wrong. This is a
you
problem.
We all need one of those. We absolutely exactly. need one of those. Yeah.
And then I love what you're saying. So it's like creating that support network and really relying on that, being accountable to that, having the regularity of that. And it doesn't have to be every day, every week, like you have it, though that works for you. It's finding what works, but it's having that, you know. And then on top of that, that intentionality that you talk about, that you know, really being intentional about how you, who you surround yourself with, what you surround yourself with, what you put in your body, who you put in your body, and that kind of sense of just, yeah, nourishment comes in many forms. You know, it's not, it's about food, it's about people, it's about, you know, spiritual practices, it's about going on nice walks, it's about whatever it is, but being intentional about it, not just getting caught up and swept up and just in whatever it is, but choosing. And I think, yeah, they're wonderful tips you're giving. And that sense of, you know, the major one about not getting swept up in social media, because social media is all about creating a bubble. It's about reinforcing any neurotic traits you might have to the extreme. And, you know, once you follow one hashtag, that's it. So it's like, it's relying more on the people that you love and trust, finding a healthy therapist or coach or practitioner who you again trust, because practitioners and coaches and therapists are all humans as well, so it's finding the right one for you. And then really, yeah, continuing to do the work on yourself, whether you're in or out of a relationship, and that when you notice toxic behaviors happening, rather than labeling the full relationship or the other person as toxic, it's questioning and like, what's actually going on here? What can I do? And relying on your network and nourishment, and so that you're no longer relying on someone else to sort of fulfill you, and when it doesn't work, that you feel like your whole world suddenly gets toxic or gets intense, but instead that you have that sort of grounding and anchoring and stability in yourself, in your community, in your practices, and that kind of thing.
Absolutely. And they do take time. And people who say, I just don't have time for that, I always call them on the priorities side of things rather than the time side of things, because sometimes we can, you know, okay, so I don't have time to speak to my friend. They only want 5 minutes of my time every day, but I don't have time. Okay, so do you ever make your bed? Yeah, I make my bed every day. How long does it take you? About 5 minutes. So what if you called your friend every time you're making your bed? So 5 minute check-in. Oh, or leave a voice note while you make. Yeah, I could do that. Great. It's called habit stacking. You already do that habit. You stack something on top of it that is a new habit that takes no extra time. And these are the sorts of things that can come out of a coaching session where you can find time with your coach. And you're right. You know, when it comes to that accountability, if you're looking for a coach, you should be making sure it's the right coach for you. You should be asking them, what's their diversity and inclusion policy? What is their accountability? How do they deal with the issues that you bring up in the coaching arena? You need to be asking them, what are their policies, procedures, and practices? Who holds them accountable? Are they part of the International Coaches Federation, or have they just bunged up a website and said, yeah, I'm a coach, I can do this? So you are absolutely entitled to ask all the questions that help you feel safe with your coach.
I love that. I love that we've gone full circle to talking about that kind of safety and support, not in all relationships, including with your coach. Ali, how can people find out more about you and your work?
I am most active on Instagram, and that is Ali Hendry Coaching. You can also find out lots of information about me on my website, which is alihendry.co.uk.
Brilliant. Thank you so, so much for your time today. I've really enjoyed it.
Absolute pleasure.